could I ask you just a quick changeover here? With the next panel coming up to be led by our colleague. Thank you very much, gentlemen. That was extremely stimulating and one which we identified a number of points which we'd like to explore more in the roundtable. And they include things like what are the appropriate institutional arrangements, what levels of support are needed, how do we drive demand, and what lessons can we learn from our foreign colleagues. This next panel is actually going to take up that last question. We would want to look, Clark McFadden, who will lead this, you've already had the privilege of hearing, but one of the comic comments that Clark sometimes makes is that the United States government is a strange beast because it has no rear view mirror. And we often don't look back at what we've done. We assess programs in the work we do, and one of the most famous comments we ever had from our friends at the National Institutes of Health, we asked them, what happened after you made the award? And their answer very sincerely was, well, we often wondered. And I think we need to do just a trifle better. And the advantage we have here is we'll be able to talk a little bit about the CEMATEC model. We're, again, very much in debt for our friends from IMEC for coming in. And, of course, we have a leading national lab. And could I introduce Clark McFadden? Oh, and, excuse me, one last thing. Would you please pull those mics forward? They're getting intermittent on you. So as close as comfortable. Thank you.
We're short on time here, so we'd like to move forward as quickly as we can. We have really three of the leading institutions in collaborative research represented here today. I'd like to just start by saying John Kelly has been a leader not only in technology and his own company, but in driving all sorts of collaborative research throughout the country and throughout the world, from university levels, university and industry, government and industry, and a variety of forms, both at the state and federal level. And couldn't have a more knowledgeable and effective leader to talk about collaborative research. John?
Good morning. Once again, John Kelly from IBM. If you don't know who IBM is, I don't know where you've been. I'd like to approach this problem from the other extreme. A lot of discussion this morning on generating demand side and a lot of discussion around manufacturing productivity. But I would argue that this industry has no future if it does not understand that it has to tackle this through technology. It has to be driven through R&D. The 5 to 10x gap in efficiency cannot be closed through larger slices of glass or more efficient equipment. It has to be solved through technology. And then once that gap is closed, you cannot assume that you can stand still there. Second point I would make is that if you want to really compete against other companies and countries outside the U.S., I would argue that, again, you can't fight that through labor cost. You can't fight that through having larger, more productive equipment. You fight that through innovation. You really do innovate faster than anyone else on the planet. What I'd like to do is draw a few analogies for you and sort of give you a few lessons learned around collaboration in the semiconductor industry, because to a large extent, a lot of these problems we've wrestled with in the semiconductor industry over the last 30 or 40 years. The semiconductor industry has basically these four fundamental pressures on it on a continuing basis, all of which have caused the industry to shake, vibrate, restructure itself numerous times over the past several decades. Just looking around the chart, we have, just as was mentioned here, continually we are under constant competition from low-cost entities, foreign governments, government subsidies. The equipment and materials ecosystem that supports the semiconductor industry also has gone through cycles. It is wonderful to see Mark Pinto stand up here and show how successful Applied Materials is doing. But if you go back into the early 1980s, I can remember when Applied Materials was a very, very fragile company and was in danger of not existing any longer due to threats from particularly companies in Japan. I'll show you some of the things we did to shore up that ecosystem, and I think that needs to be done here as well. A highly educated skills workforce. The minute you decide you're going to compete based on innovation, you better have one of the most highly skilled workforces in the world, and that is not a point in time. That is a pipeline statement all the way through the education system. And then lastly, R&D costs. Leading nodes in logic technology now are approximately $1 billion of R&D investment per node. You need to be doing 3 to 4 nodes at any given point in time. So pull that together. You can see that that's a big, big investment that each company, if done alone, would have to make themselves. Couple that with the fact that the semiconductor industry revenue has slowed from high teens to mid single digits, the gap between the growth rate of revenue and R&D has narrowed and put the industry under extreme pressure. So this has caused the industry to do things that, honestly, we probably would not have done otherwise had we not been under all this pressure. The solution is collaboration. It's been mentioned several times here this morning, and it's collaboration between industry, government, and universities. Now, there's countless examples of collaboration in the semiconductor industry, but I'd like to talk about a few. The first is the Semiconductor Research Corporation, which is at the intersection of industry and universities. The second is Semitech, which is at the intersection of industry and government, and even the government involvement has shifted over time. The third and fourth are a new initiative around nanotechnology, the Nanotechnology Research Initiative, and the focus research programs. These are at the intersection of all three and are highly successful. And as I indicate on the chart, most recently we've aligned those efforts with the efforts of NIST and NSF, who I know are here today, to further leverage into pure government university research in alignment with where industry needs to go. And then lastly, I'd like to just show one quick chart on extraordinary collaboration going on just within industry players who you might think under normal circumstances are severe competitors, but we have managed to pull together a level of collaboration which I think is probably unprecedented anyplace else in the world. So this is the map, and I'd like to step through and just give you a little bit of a history on each one of these. The four I'll focus on in the industry I mentioned. Let me talk about Semitech. Semitech originated back in the mid-80s, but came through with government funding in the late 1980s. It was judged to be, frankly, a national crisis. It wasn't so much the we were seeing loss of share in the U.S. semiconductor industry, but we were also seeing the entire equipment and materials base leaving the U.S. And that was a disaster to companies like Intel and IBM, who felt that our supply lines and our own security of our own systems would be in jeopardy if that occurred. So working together with government in a very, very large way, we established Semitech. $100 million each from industry and government, which at that time, I think, again, was unprecedented in terms of the amount of investment. I will tell you my personal opinion, the question on how much it will take to advance the R&D and really close this gap on the competitiveness of the technology in solar. We are not talking tens of millions of dollars, ladies and gentlemen. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars of investment per year need to be invested in this PV industry if we want to get off of the subsidies and make it competitive and keep the U.S. in a leadership position. It is hundreds of millions of dollars per year. So these kinds of numbers, while you might think the semiconductor industry, $200 billion industry, I think that's the kind of investment that's required for this industry. Semitech itself, although established in the late 80s, morphed in a number of different ways. Morphed in terms of the involvement, it certainly grew, but it went beyond sort of core R&D, core support of equipment. It did begin to address things like standards around the industry, interface standards between equipment, standards around wafer sizes, standards about packaging and shipping and other sorts of things which we often take for granted, but really make the whole industry more efficient. And then lastly, as you can see on the chart, we found some ways to really reach out and now start to bring in global players in areas that we think are not necessarily threats to the U.S. semiconductor industry. It's grown in number of players, as you can see, as many of the founding members, the IBMs and Intels, still are members of this. And as you can see on the bottom, we've pulled in many more members. It's also meant big investments. Top left facility is the investment in Austin, Texas, that was built on 8-inch wafers. It was the core central R&D facility for Semitech. It's where the equipment industry, the material suppliers, the small semiconductor companies who could not provide their own development lines and pilot lines went to work. That facility did a great job for us for nearly two decades. As we saw the end of that capability and we moved to 300-millimeter wafers or 12-inch wafers, we needed a new facility. And as you can see in the bottom right, this capability in Albany, New York is a full-fledged 300-millimeter R&D facility with between investments in from New York State and IBM, multi-billion-dollar facility. And that facility has been open to Semitech now. And it's actually Semitech North is where most of the advanced work is now being done. In terms of return, believe me, these numbers are real. If anybody examines these kinds of returns, it's the IBM company. And these leverages for the return on our investment range from 5x to 20x, depending on the projects. But in all cases, you're not talking about leverage of 10 or 20%. You're talking about factors of leverage in the investment when you pool your resources between seeming competitors in the industry. And it's allowed us to, over the years, sustain the viability of our industry. Let me talk for a minute about, then, Semiconductor Research Corporation. So here, think not only the technology and the innovation, but think about that pipeline of skills that I referred to earlier, that if you decide you're going to compete based on innovation versus lowest cost only, you have to have the skills to innovate. SRC was formed in 1982, again, under this impending threat from the share of the industry moving to Japan, and we knew that we had to not only have Semitech sort of R&D collaboration, but we needed to have a pipeline of skills. So again, we formed a consortium between industry players to support fundamentally university-based research. It is now, I think, by far the largest and most successful of these types of collaborations. We've seen huge growth in the number of faculty and students. You can see on the chart. There were about 100 students doing research in the semiconductor area back in 1982. That has now grown dramatically. When you look at the output of it, lots of ways to measure output. We all take key technologies from key universities. But if you just look at patents or publications, here we show publications, you can see that it is truly an R&D engine in and of itself being done at universities. And the output, in many cases, is larger in some dimensions than even some of the largest corporations in the industry. The program has, you can see from this chart, grown substantially. We've put thousands of highly qualified students into the industry, most hired by the member companies, tremendous amount of patents, publications, technology, that has helped us over the years keep driving leadership in the industry. So think in terms of going from 100, 200 researchers in our industry to thousands through over 200 universities in the U.S. SRC has also grown. It has not been stagnant. It's grown to encompass a global research collaboration group, which does work with foreign companies. It manages the next two projects I'll talk about, the Focused Research Center and the Nanotech. It's got an education component, and an area which might be something that the PV industry can grab onto, a topical research collaboration capability, where companies can come together and work when they're not necessarily full members of SRC on projects that are of interest to them. And in fact, there is a PV project starting under the technology research collaboration that this industry may want to take a look at. Focus center research programs. This, again, is the one, now we're getting into where government, industry, and universities are all collaborating together. Here we saw challenges again in our roadmap. You saw the roadmap being shown. We continually see roadblocks 5 and 10 years out to our technology. We established another center, set of centers here, university-based, to look farther out at our roadmap and do more work before we hit the wall, as we refer to it in the industry. This Focus Center Research Program is funded jointly by the Semiconductor Industry Association members and DARPA. The program's grown to be about $40 million, $20 million each, which, you know, again, on the scale of billion-dollar factories, is not a lot, but when you put $40 million into the university system, not into an industry, that makes a big difference in the economics of the universities. We've established 5 centers across the bottom, aimed at different segments of the problem, some in design, some in materials, some in interconnect wiring, et cetera. And it really does represent the who's who and the best universities in the U.S. We have a management system around members of the Semiconductor Industry Association, all senior executives at the companies. And through SRC, we have an organization we call MARCO, which manages this. My comment here is, if you're looking to form collaborative work between industry, universities, and the government, there is a model here where the processes, the mechanisms, from the money flow all the way through the intellectual property, which is non-trivial, all of those issues have been solved through these mechanisms. And as we said earlier, Chuck was saying, be quick, time counts here. I would suggest that this industry needs to lift as much as this as possible and just, you know, relatively blindly adopt many of these processes. The Nanotechnology Research Initiative is the last of the large collaborative efforts across the industry I'll speak to. This was even a longer term, beyond 5 or 10 years. As we looked out, we said, look, we're sitting here now at 45 nanometer devices, going to 32, going to 22. In labs like mine, we know how to build 8-nanometer devices. So we've got a few more turns of the crank left with the wonderful transistor that was invented at Bell Labs back in 1957. But beyond that, we're going to need a new switch, something way beyond the transistor as we know it today. And so here, this effort in nanotechnology looks beyond the current silicon switch into alternate structures, nanotubes, quantum devices, et cetera, so that we have those technologies developed when we need them. Here again, what we did is we reached out to the university system in the U.S. and established a number of large centers, West Coast, Texas, and by and large Northeast, all jointly funded, as I'll show you in a minute, from the industry, with some government alignment and a lot of state funding. And in a sense, key industry members adopted these centers as mentors, if you will. See, it's not surprising that you'd see Intel mentoring the West Coast Center, TI in Texas and the South, and IBM mentoring the group in the Northeast. My comment on this is that these collaborative efforts are not with individual universities. These are clusters of universities that we've managed to get to work together. If you think it was hard to get industry to work together, by the way, getting universities to work together is maybe the largest accomplishment we'll ever have, Clark, from the NRI. But you really do have competing, quote unquote, universities collaborating and picking off pieces of the problem and aligning their work to solve the issues. Again, we've had great participation across members of the Semiconductor Industry Association, and over its 4 or 5 year history, we've really developed a number of new technologies across the key areas that we think are going to be problems for the industry. Again, we've established 4 centers around the U.S. The Mind Center is the most recent. It's in the Midwest, centered around Purdue and Notre Dame. They're looking at very, very novel alternate device structures. So again, industry, universities, government collaborating to put some serious money over long-term problems. And frankly speaking, the kinds of work that's being done across these universities and the scale it's being done is something that even an IBM or an Intel would not independently be able to put into that long-term roadmap. Let me just finish then. Now I'm in the industry-only collaboration. I've gone through four examples of collaboration in universities, industry, academia. In this case, within IBM, we said, look, $1 billion a node, three, four nodes any given point in time, we have to do something different. We have to change this model. So we began about a decade ago bringing in two industrial partners. We now have eight companies from around the world collaborating, working in our labs with large numbers of people, sharing the risks associated with this, sharing the investments in very, very advanced technology nodes. The interesting part of this collaboration is not just the technology that it advanced, but it began to pull together a very, very large cluster of buying power across the industry. That began to attract, and we invested in sort of the next ring of the ecosystem around manufacturing, design IP, design IP tools, and that has since subsequently grown out to include even the equipment suppliers, so that Mark Pinto and Applied Materials, just as Tokyo Electron and ASML in Europe, are three very, very large collaborators and investors in this ecosystem and the advancement of this ecosystem. So I show this in conclusion as just an example of even within industry, you can form these very, very radical collaborative efforts to tackle very, very large multi-billion dollar investment problems. And I think whether it's this or SRC or Semitech or NRI, I think there are many, many lessons here that this industry needs to draw upon and move very, very quickly. Particularly, I think, since many of these mechanisms are recognized by DARPA and DOE, and therefore, if mechanisms are required to get the funding through quickly, these things should be able to be leveraged very quickly. So thank you very much.
We are now fortunate to have with us Johan von Elleput, who represents IMEC, one of the most highly respected consortiums in Europe and throughout the world.
Thank you so much. I'm most honored and pleased to be here with you and to represent IMEC here in this distinguished forum. Let me first begin a little bit with a piece of history. Back in 84, IMEC was created by the late Roger van Overstrade, who graduated in Stanford and saw at that moment the huge opportunities of microelectronics, and he wanted to create a research lab but realized very quickly that the investment needed to do that were surpassing largely the capabilities of single universities. So he went to the government of Flanders and asked to build a new inter-university microelectronics center. That's where the name IMEC comes from. We started with a little, with about 70 people and 62 million euros of starting budget. Last year, we were at 270 million euros in overall budget of research. And we are now 25 years old. Now, that is the what we call the IMEC campus. So we have two major clean rooms. One is operating in 200 millimeter wafer size, and one is operating at a 300 millimeter wafer size, which is a kind of full, let's say, pilot line, but for doing nothing else than research. We are not manufacturing anything. We are working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in order to get the maximum out of that very expensive equipment. Now, that is an evolution of the, let's say, the revenues of IMEC, and we see that we start in 84, and we went up to 270 million last year. What was very important also is that we had to solve, and that is important for the business model I will be talking about, we had to solve what we call the taxpayer's paradox. In the early days of EMEC, when Van Overstraeten could convince the Flemish government to get some structural funding into EMEC, well, that's fine. But when we had to work, he wanted to work on a global basis, since he realized that Flanders, being a very small region, he never could mean anything without having a global reach. Now, convincing the government to put structural funding and taxpayers' money into an institute that was working predominantly with foreign companies was what we called the taxpayers' paradox. So we said, instead of solving individual problems of individual companies, we should try to identify more generic problems for a class of companies. And I will come back to that. But that was very important to do that in order to have also a kind of return to the local economy. And we made some macroeconomic impact studies of EMEC for the region. And we could figure out that the economic impact was a factor 10 times the amount of money put into it by the government. So that was a good point. And you see here the amount of structural funding, that's the gray line here. That's what the government puts in as a structural funding, and we are dealing there, and that's very important, with 5-year contracts. So that means that we can have a commitment of over 200 million euros for a period of 5 years in order to plan and to structure our longer-term strategy. Here you see that if we take away the structural grant from the government, that we look upon contract revenues, that is the split of contract revenues, and you see that 76% is coming from international companies from worldwide collaboration. And that is very important. And yet, we still have 13% of that total revenue is coming from local companies, which is amazingly high for such a small region. Here you see an evolution of the people. What is very important here is the gray area. Those are non-payroll members. Those are industrial people, predominantly industrial people. You see here 350 company researchers residing at EMEC and forming mixed research teams with EMEC researchers. And on top of that, we have 185 PhD students working at EMEC. We have over 60 different nationalities working at EMEC in that total of about 1,700 people, of which 1,000 Belgians. business model approaches now. Well, and that has been very nicely given by John, how to deal with such a huge cost of research combined with a very rapid cycle of change, since in that business, technology evolution is extremely fast. So if you have, and at the same time, you have many, many options. If you have, as a company, to tackle all those challenges on your own, it's a big challenge. So the answer is indeed, as John was saying very correctly, partnering in R&D. And most companies have a certain percentage of their revenue that they are spending on R&D. And they could spend everything in their own budget on an exclusive way, and that's the research access that they reach them. Or they could spend part of the money in a research platform like Sematic or like EMEC and have a much larger R&D reach. And they could do that at a number of places in the world, and so they're each time extending their R&D reach, each time looking how to differentiate between nice-to-have, must-have, and core business, and at the same time to leverage, as was mentioned very clearly, on their investments. Now, the EMEC approach, I mentioned that we started from saying that we were looking for generic problems a little bit earlier on the life cycle. And so we try to create what we call a program offering. We define a technical annex, and we go out to the market and say that's what we are intending to do for the couple for the next 3 years, for instance. And then we try to sign up with, and that's very important, with individual companies on a bilateral basis, different contracts, partner A, partner B, partner C, partner E, and so on. And each time we ask them to send an industrial resident or more industrial residents in order to do the joint research with EMEC team. And we have an IP rule as such that any foreground information being created together in that execution of that technical annex is being co-owned without any accounting to each other by the industrial partner having contributed to the research and the EMEC researchers. If for certain elements of the program, the industrial partner is not contributing, he gets then a license on the foreground for own use so that he has no blind spots in using the technology back home. At the same time, we are providing also a non-exclusive license to the background information of EMEC needed to perform and to execute the foreground results. And finally, we also offer the opportunities next to the shared part, what we call the R1 parts, we also can tune the generic results to the specific condition of individual companies, and that is then on an exclusive basis. We have an entrance fee when they join the program, and then we have a yearly, what we call, affiliation fee. What we also see is that more and more, based on two kind of approaches, we call that the EMEX Industrial Affiliation Program, that we also start working out inside the core business on a bilateral project basis with companies as well. What is very important for us, for each company, is not to have exclusive ownership on each subset of IP, but to have an exclusive or a unique IP fingerprint. And that does not necessarily mean that you should have exclusive ownership on each single subset of IP, but the total portfolio should be unique. And that is the basic idea behind it. Now, what is also very important is that many research labs have a research infrastructure, and they have what we call technology platforms, and they try to use that to solve problems of industry. Well, then you have one leverage point here. The more that you can use your research infrastructure for different competences and platforms, the higher that leverage is. But if you form programs, then you have multiple technology programs that you can offer and derive to many application fields. And at the same time, you could offer them to multiple partners. So you're building leverage on leverage on leverage, and you can reuse to the mechanism of co-ownership without any accounting to each other on the foreground results. You can build a number of leverage effects. And that was basically one of the elements of the crowd dynamics of EMEC behind it. Now, a couple of quick words on EMEC strategic orientations. While industry is now making a distinction more and more between what we call more and more, going further down on the scaling down and maximizing the performance of chips. And at the same time, there is more than more in the sense that you put a maximum of functionality on a single chip. While we are being structured in the same way, we have one unit acting on process technology and one on smart systems and energy. The first one is predominantly working on the cost per function, as was mentioned earlier, and there lithography was a very instrumental path of research. And the second one is on device performance, where materials, new materials, are extremely important. And we are now here working on the 22 and 16 nanometer, and starting also on 16 and beyond. And new materials and device research is very instrumental in that. The point is also that you have many, many technological options, and that is exactly what EMEC tries to do, is to explore different options to give fundamental insight to the companies so that they can at an early stage see which one has a chance to become a winner on the market. We also engage a lot in three-dimensional integration. Instead of planar chips, we're going in a third dimension, stacking chips one to each other, quite often chips of only a thickness of 15 micrometer. And here we have also a kind of core partner system. So we have a menu of different research programs in process technology, for instance, but a core partner can subscribe all the total menu, all the programs together, and that's what we are calling core partners. And here you see the different core partners that we have around the world. Here you see that we were shifting indeed towards 22 and 16 nanometer. And what we also try to do, and that was mentioned by John very correctly, is to bring together the ecosystem. You have the leading IDMs, you have memory suppliers, you have logic suppliers, you have equipment and material suppliers, you have pure foundries, you have, and that's pretty new, more and more fab-lite and fabless companies, since once you're getting below 45 nanometer, you have process variabilities, and the design world has to come up with part of the solution. And around each ecosystem, we are trying to build a number of partnerships in the same program offerings. Next to that, we also have what we call a CMOR activity, and that's pretty new, where we are trying to build on the existing infrastructure and expertise and technology platforms what we call custom application solutions. Companies may have a brilliant new idea, and they cannot get it materialized or implemented in a commercial setting. Then we can, together with them, try to find a solution to their ideas and see whether it's feasible technically speaking, and then it can be ported, if successful and there is a big market, can be ported to a commercial setting. One example here was a partner asking us to put on a chip 10 million mirrors which should be steered on an individual basis. And that chip could not be larger than 10 square centimeters. Well, we had it working, and we made it, and it had 10 to the 12 cycles without any fatigue, no creep. And that was a typical example of what we call C-More activities. Next to that, there is more than more. We are working on biomedical applications, on a smart environment, the ambient intelligence, as we call it, and also on energy, renewable energies. Let me very quickly go here. I will, on, let's say, communication technologies. We are working on cognitive reconfigurable radio, on above 60 gigahertz communication, and on ultra-low power radio for sensor networks. Biomedical, we have activities in wearable and health comfort, body area networks, remote monitoring, smart implants, and also on what we call creating brain computer interfaces, growing neurons on a chip for many different applications, and finally also an activity on biosensor technology based on different nanotechnology disciplines. We recently created also a new center together with the Flemish Institute of Biotechnology, the Leuven University, and the Flanders government, NERF, which is a center for neuroelectronics research in Flanders, where we are combining neuroelectronics with neurobiology, with medical imaging, and also with experimental neurosurgery. Now, going to very quickly to PV, well, we have chosen as a main workhorse to go on with silicon crystalline silicon PV for the simple reason that we have a lot of expertise in silicon anemic. That's the major logic. And we do believe that there is room for both thin film and crystalline silicon technology in the future. Of course, as was mentioned this morning, the number of grams per watt peak should go dramatically down. So we have to thin the wafers that we are using. And at the same time, with thinner active layers, we have to increase the efficiency above 20%. Reduction of manufacturing costs, speeding up the PV learning curve. And we are very grateful for the tremendous success of companies like First Solar, which are driving and pushing us to increase also the roadmap for silicon PV. We have, as I mentioned, silicon PV. We have also an activity on organic PV and also on concentrated PV. I will just put it very briefly to your attention. What we are now on the edges of launching a program, the same model as was explained just a minute ago, on crystalline silicon PV research. And we have a number of modules, as is depicted here, with two major programs. One is going on bulk wafer-based approaches, and the second one is on epitaxial thin film on silicon. What we try to do here again is to bring new process technologies together with new device concepts and new cell concepts, and bringing the ecosystem together. And what we do in the first step is the rear processing, rear surface processing, to introduce that. Then to go to full interdigitated back contacts, no contacts on the front side any longer. Then to go to layer transfer processes for 40 micron thick cells. And then there is also an AP layer on, let's say, growing epitaxially silicon on metallurgic grade silicon, or later on glass. Here, what we are aiming at basically is above 20% on large area, and on 120 micron thick wafers by 2011 in the iPearl. iPearl was one of the steps you remember in the program offering. The next one is I2BC with no contacts on the front side. There we wish to go over 20% on 100 micron thick wafers. Also large area, not a tiny little piece, but on a large wafer. And then also here is an example how we try to experiment with new liftoff techniques, where you induce a kind of stress-inducing layer, you activate the stress, and you peel off a very tiny 100 micron thick today. Ultimately, we wish to reduce that to 20 microns thick, a foil. It's a silicone foil that you can process then later on. Here you see a very quick example how it is being induced. You just peel it off, and it looks like this. And we can process already today. We reach 10% efficiency, and ultimate goal is to reach 20% efficiency on a 20 micron thick silicone foil. Also in terms of epitaxial cells, what we try to do is to improve the optical confinement of the approach by introducing a layer of porous silicon, for instance, and to avoid and to have reflection of the incoming photons so that you increase a little bit the efficiency of your approach on that side. And here we reached already today on a lab scale 16% on this approach of AP layer. I will go very quickly on OPV. We have also an activity. It's a full organic approach where you're trying to put together a pilot line. Here the business model is not yet fully defined yet. Those are the aims that we are going for from an OPV perspective, an organic PV. And finally, we have also, you have the CPV, the concentrated PV. And I guess the monolithic approach of NREL is state of the art, is a very excellent approach. And yet we try to find out whether there are some alternatives, but instead of having a monolithic approach, by having a stacked approach, where each single cell is being connected individually. And it's a little bit more complex, but you avoid tunnel junctions, you avoid current matching, and we think that we can increase the efficiency by doing that. But that is still at the stage of feasibility. We still have to prove that. Now, two slides to end with. The European, that is the Solar Europe Industrial Initiative, has come up with a kind of roadmap, and they are trying to reach 12% of PV electricity being generated by PV by 2020. Now, the Energy Institute of the Joint Research Center of the European Commission calculated that if that were to happen, they had to, that is the equivalent of about 420 terawatt hours. It's a huge amount, or the equivalent of, roughly speaking, 350 gigawatt of PV capacity by 2020. So it's quite ambitious, and I just stated it as it is being put forward, and 20% by 2030. Here they are the key performance indicators that they are putting forward. One of the points that they are stressing very much also is that the lifetime of modules should be 40 years by 2020. Well, with this slide, I would like to end my presentation, and I hope at least that you got a little bit of flavor of what EMEC is about. Thank you so much.
We now move to more direct focus, perhaps, on photovoltaics with Robert Margolis of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to talk a little bit about public-private R&D collaborations and lessons from a couple of PV partnerships, so specifically on photovoltaics. I'll start out with a little bit of background on industry trends, the sort of the growth in installations and also some of the investment trends. I think that's relevant. I'll talk about the DOE solar program's historical funding and its evolving R&D focus. In particular, I'll mention a recent partnership, the Technology Pathway Partnerships, that were launched about 2 years ago. And then I'll talk a little bit more in detail, sort of history, on the photovoltaic manufacturing R&D project. I'll call that the PV MAT project. And discuss some of its collaborative aspects. It was a project that was started in the early 1990s, and then offer some concluding thoughts. So I'm surprised we didn't really see this slide in this form yet today. This shows the global PV production and U.S. market share from 1990 to 2008. So, and again, in 1980, the U.S. was more than 75% of global production of PV, but it was a very, very small market. And we saw that it came down into the sort of the 30 to 50% range in the 1990s, and now we've dropped down below 10% of global production. We saw that first Japan came in pretty strong, then Europe in the past 10 years or so, and in the past couple of years, China and Taiwan in particular have captured significant market share. So we've seen a lot of growth. But you think about it, it's still a relatively small industry. So, you know, in the U.S., we have 1,000 gigawatts of electricity capacity installed. So we're still, even if we're talking about, you know, we're in the U.S., we're talking a couple hundred megawatts annually installed. If we get into the gigawatt range, we're still going to, it still takes a long time to transform a system that's that large. But we have seen a dramatic growth in investments in solar energy technologies. So here we show both the venture capital and private equity bar in green, also solar debt and public equity. And here we've seen, you know, just five or six years ago, we were talking tens of millions of dollars going into the sector from the private sector on an annual basis. And now we're talking tens of billions of dollars. It's been a dramatic change. And it's had a very big impact on the way the industry is organized, how it does R&D, how it interacts with the government, et cetera. So I think it's worth understanding. I don't know what the total venture capital investment in the semiconductor industry was, but does anybody know what the order on the panel? Do you guys know what the? No. Okay. I tried to look it up yesterday, but I couldn't find it real quick online and ran out of time. If we look at the particularly that slice on the venture capital and private equity piece, we see there's a real regional differentiation. And I think this is critical for understanding. Yes, the U.S. has lost its share of global production. But in terms of investment in sort of cutting-edge photovoltaic technologies, we still have a lot of money going into that area, and it's a very diverse investment. So if we look at on the U.S. side, we see that our investments, we have a very significant chunk of investments going into thin film technologies, into next generation, into multi-junction, and also concentrating solar power, which isn't our topic today, and also CPV technologies. Whereas in Asia, the dominant investment has been in existing crystalline technologies. We see a little bit of shift there in the past year, a little bit of thin film. And the same thing in Europe. We've also seen sort of a heavier investment in mono and polycrystalline, both in terms of the technology and also investment in terms of the scale-up of the investment. But so, again, if we think about where the U.S. is in terms of bringing these new technologies into the marketplace, we're actually pretty well-positioned in a lot of ways. And I think that complements what we do on the federal side in terms of investing. So right now, I think there are about 200 companies that got private sector investment in the past 3 years. More than 100 of those are in the U.S. So that leads into projections about where the industry is going to go over the next couple of years. So we see that most of the analysts that are out there, and this is sort of based on a survey of about a dozen analysts on Wall Street mostly, and some of the folks that follow the industry as consultants, we see that people are expecting about a five-fold increase in the technology over the next couple of years. It is interesting to note, and you know, Mike Ahern sort of mentioned that First Solar is expecting to be about a gigawatt. Well, the whole industry was only a gigawatt a couple of years ago, but now we're expecting to be at 20 to 25 gigawatts. But most of the analysts are still saying that crystalline silicon is likely to be the dominant technology in that sort of 3 to 5 year time frame. But things can change really fast, and new technologies come in, and you end up in a global economic crisis, and there's lots of change too. So I think that there's a lot of possibility for the future to look very different than the past has. We'll see where we end up. In terms of industry revenues, we also see that industry revenues are expected to continue to grow very rapidly in the industry, are sort of around $30 billion in revenues. So that puts us, I think, where the semiconductor industry was back in the early 1980s. So maybe this is the perfect time to have this discussion about whether Semitech is the right model as the industry is getting to the scale of production where we're talking about billions of dollars of investment required for new fab facilities, in essence. And with the expectation that we're going to grow into sort of the $100 to $200 billion annual revenue pool range over the next 5 or 6 years. Again, it's the numbers were larger last year when people were making projections, and they've come down significantly in the context of the changing economic environment. So Now I'm going to switch a little bit to the DOE solar program. So the DOE solar program has had a budget that increased substantially in 2007 under the Solar America Initiative. Went from about $80 million, so I got to get back to millions, not billions here, $80 million to about $160 to $170 million on an annual basis. So we do have substantial resources from the government that are flowing in, and there's an expectation that those will increase under the new administration here over the next couple of years. And we try to use that those resources in a way to leverage private sector, and there's a whole host of different ways we collaborate with the private sector. So if we look at the DOE solar program, this is how we envision our R&D pipeline. It's not really a linear process. It has a lot of feedbacks and interactions across it. And over the past couple of years, as we've expanded the program, we've been filling in this R&D pipeline. And I'm going to actually focus on one piece of it, which is this technology pathway partnerships, which, since the topic here was partnerships, I thought I'd focus in on that. But we do a lot of work in the earlier stage where we're sort of collaborative interaction with universities and also sort of in other parts of the supply chain that we're looking at. So just a couple slides on the technology pathway partnerships. So the technology pathway partnerships started in 1997. It was $168 million in DOE funds, basically doubling that with matched industry funds over a three-year period. And the original vision was to have three phases over the course of about 9 or 10 years, so at that level of funding. So it's about $50 million of government money on an annual basis going to partnerships with, and again, this was kind of a shift from what the DOE had been doing prior to that, where we were focusing largely on sort of the device level. Here under these technology pathway partnerships, we have had a much stronger focus on thinking about total system cost reductions. So it was partnering companies across the value chain to develop these sort of multi industrial, university, et cetera, partner teams. So if we look at within the TPPs, there were over 50 companies, 14 universities, 3 nonprofits, and 2 national laboratories involved in that. And we can see that some of these partnerships are pretty big. So BP Solar's, for example, has 16 partners in it, I should say. Also, SunPower is one of the partners. And actually, SunPower and PowerLight were combined into a single TPP, so they're sort of on a similar level of number of people brought into this process. So again, it was fostering this interaction across the entire value chain to get people to think about reducing total system cost. That's one style of collaborative R&D, as opposed to focusing on those sort of common area issues across multiple companies that you might want to, you know, also think about. So again, this was in some sense an experiment that we were trying. Now I'm going to shift to discuss the PV Mat project a little bit. And again, this is a project, this is a little more sort of historical here, to think about where we've been. This was started in 1991, and the original goal was to ensure that the U.S. Industry retain and extend its world leadership role in manufacturing. So again, this is that period when we had come down from 75% of the market share down to about 30 to 50%, and everybody said, if we're going to retain this industry, we need to do something about getting this into the manufacturability side of things so that we can retain some leadership. The focus of the project was on improving manufacturing processes and equipment, accelerating manufacturing cost reductions, improving commercial product performance and reliability, and laying the groundwork for substantial scale-up of U.S.-based manufacturing plant capacities. So that was in the early 1990s. The project funded about $151 million in federal money, which again leveraged private sector money about a 50-50 cost share. And it used a multi-year contracting approach. At the time, it was pretty innovative in that for DOE. Also, cost sharing was also sort of a shift from cost-plus contracting to cost-sharing contracting at that time, too. So, but that, again, has become pretty common in government R&D funding. And about three-quarters of the projects completed were able to sort of quantify their cost reductions and scale up of their manufacturing over that period. So here we see the 14 of the participants in the PVMAP project how their costs came down over the period between 1992 and 2005. So we see that there was an average cost of manufacturing decline about 54%, and the manufacturing capacity increased by more than 17, about by more than a factor of 17. So there are very significant improvements in the technology, and again, we could carry that forward. That's pretty much the end of where this project was. So if we think about some of the collaborative aspects, and the first one is cost sharing. So cost sharing was a primary tool used to share the risk of R&D with industrial participants. Again, it was pretty innovative in many ways at the time in some of the ways that it sort of set up the cost sharing. It had a multi-tiered approach to cost sharing for differentiating between small and large firms. But again, a lot of those things have become pretty standard. So it's also built into the proposal evaluation process. So it's, again, pretty straightforward. In terms of collaborative aspects of the PVMAT project, I'm going to just briefly touch on four specific aspects of collaboration. So the first is a problem identification phase that was included. So when the project was launched in 1991, 22 firms were selected through a competitive bidding process and sort of to do a problem identification phase. So for $50,000, each of the companies had 3 months to study the problem and produce a report of sort of a mini roadmap for that company. Companies were told up front that in order to participate in phase two, which were going to be sort of a, you know, sort of the, I think it was a $2 or $3 million over a couple of years level of funding, that they needed to participate in phase one. It got people involved in the process. It got a lot of cross dialogue, and it also was an effective tool for bringing the Department of Energy and NREL up to speed on this new area that they hadn't really been involved in previous years. So it was a good way to get the process started in a collaborative fashion. Again, I think some of the aspects of Semitech and other collaborators have used similar sort of mechanisms, so it's a good way to start things. Also, the proposal evaluation process was carried out by an independent panel of representatives from industry, government, and universities, and there was a very restrictive amount of government involvement in that. So it was, I think there was one or two people from the labs, from NREL and Sandia, I think one from each lab, on a panel of 12 people that would evaluate the proposals. And the managers, both within NREL and DOE, gave a lot of latitude to these panels to sort of make decisions. At the end of the day, the decision always comes back to DOE. It has to make the final decisions on these types of things. But it did take them very seriously to help provide legitimacy and also to sort of get a lot of buy-in into what the project was doing. So again, another important feature. The challenge of that approach is they have to give up some control over the process potentially on government side, which can be a little bit tough for some people. And it's also very challenging to keep these panels together and to have good people on them to do good evaluations. I think one of the speakers earlier mentioned that's a time-consuming process, and we're always in this process of putting these merit review panels together and trying to get a good mix of expertise, but independence, people that don't have a tie to specific technologies or companies. They also tried something called generic team research, and here we had a little bit harder time. In 1993, they issued it was a solicitation issued for team research on generic problems, and the idea was to get people to work on cross-cutting areas that would cut across multiple companies, problems that would be helpful to multiple companies. And this really had it didn't really get off the ground very well. So in some sense, it's almost a little bit of a failure for the program, for the PVMAT program. And it really was concerns over intellectual property. So I think over time, IP issues have gotten better. Some of the legal changes on how you handle IP are better today than they were 10 years ago or 15 years ago. But they still can be a concern, particularly on these issues where multiple companies will get a they're seeking a real competitive advantage on something. So something to think about. I think that's in part what led to these technology pathway partnership structure, where we focused on a vertical collaboration, having one company as the lead with a bunch of companies tied into that, as opposed to this cross problem R&D solving issue. It also has to do with, I think, this question of barriers to entry into the industry. And I think that the semiconductor industry probably has bigger barriers to entry than the solar sector does. So again, people maybe think they can work on narrower pieces to themselves. But again, maybe this afternoon we'll have a chance to talk about that. And the last piece I wanted to mention was annual review meetings. And again, here, these just provide a venue where people could share ideas, understand what other people are doing, and learn from each other. And they created an opportunity for a good information flow between the various participants, including folks in industry, universities, and at the national labs. So there's that's a pretty standard process today to have that type of a piece in place. I do want to mention, in the interest of time, I was going to talk about the Thin Film Partnership also, which was sort of carried out in the same sort of time frame. But in the interest of time today, I had to cut that piece out. But we have the person in the audience and speaker, Ken Zweibel, who managed that program for its lifetime. So maybe he'll talk about that later if he wants to talk about it later in the roundtable part. In terms of conclusions, the PBMAT project used innovative forms of cost sharing, particularly at the time, and collaboration to strengthen the financial knowledge and information flows between industry, university, and national labs. Under the Technology Pathway Partnerships, DOE has been encouraging vertical collaboration across the value chain, which has helped move the industry from a component-level focus to a system-level focus. And I think we've seen that today in a number of the speakers, that there is a very strong focus on the systems level. And that we do know that the DOE's approach to engaging the private sector in collaborative R&D will continue to evolve as the PV industry grows and matures in its very dynamic environment. That's it. Thank you.
Chuck informs me that we have little time or no time for questions.
If anybody has a question, I'm actually just concerned if I could explain. We have Congressman Marcy Kaptur, who will be here in principle at 1:45, and we also have a hot lunch waiting for us. So those of you who don't want lunch, so could I suggest two things? We will bring, I hope we can bring, with your help, these discussion points back up in the roundtable. I'd like to congratulate you on a really outstanding, if I could have a round of applause, this is a really good panel. All right, two people. Yes, we do. Please.
Chuck, you are very generous. Thank you. I just had one question I wanted to ask about industry consortium. With the PV industry, it's an extremely diverse industry. And if you were thinking about forming an industry consortia with the diverse PV industry and specifically thinking about American competitiveness, what kind of critical mass do you need? I mean, there's probably going to be some players in our industry that decide to go it alone.
From the semiconductor experience, you need the majority of large players. It's okay if one or two popped out, but you need the majority of the large players, and you need involvement in some mechanism of the complete ecosystem. So in the case of SIA, it's the top dozen or so semiconductor CEOs, but all mechanisms through technology committees not to bring in other players. And even companies that aren't vertically integrated that might be fabless are on the board of the Semiconductor Industry Association. So you need the majority of the big players and some representation of the business.
So in our case, the big players you would think of as being the module manufacturers and maybe significant suppliers to that value chain? Okay.
The government also can add some momentum to bringing them together. That had a big big help in trying to set the context for people coming together, and it was a gradual process, but it built steadily. And when you had a critical mass, suddenly people were afraid of being left out rather than concerned about how to jump in.
Huh. Okay, thank you.
I would just say that even fierce competitors came to the table and worked together.
That's encouraging to hear. Thank you.
On that point, I think that the catalytic impact of even small amounts of government support seems to be something that can generate multiples,